Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Lake Podcast. I'm your host, Karthik Nachipan, podcasting from Singapore. Soon, India will turn 75. The last 75 years have been a remarkable journey for this country that was hopefully regarded to be and become the beachhead of democracy in the Southern Hemisphere as countries exited the war in the mid-1940s. Despite doubts, flaws, and crises, India has persisted, surprised, and at times thrived over the 20th century. How has India changed since the 1990s, when the turn was made to liberalize the Indian economy and introduce market-oriented reforms? More importantly, how are those changes conceived of and implemented in a fractious, competitive political landscape? In a path-breaking new book, Brand New Nation, political scientist Ravinder Kaur tells us the story of how the Indian state used aspects of the Indian nation to create a brand or image to generate investments into India. This social construction of the nation occurred by drafting and deploying images and ideas, harkening back to India's past to indicate or point to a new, more promising future that awaited global capital. India, of course, was not the only country that deployed this strategy. Other emerging markets with high growth potentials and business opportunities also did so to attract low-cost capital from developed countries. But what distinguishes India is the melding of aspects of the nation that extol hyper-nationalist impulses with market forces. This is an important book, but possibly the first critical treatment of how politics is being remade and reshaped in India since liberalization, which has immense implications for India's future as that solid democratic beachhead in South Asia. Here is Ravinder Kaur on Brand New Nation, Capitalist Dreams and Nationalist Designs in 21st Century India, published by Stanford University Press in 2020. Go turn back the clock to 2007 and go back to your first book. Since 1947, Partition Narratives Amongst the Punjabi Migrants of Delhi, which dealt with questions of memory, migration, and refugee resettlement policies after partition. And this book traverses and bridges several disciplines to understand and present a post-colonial India, a really vivid post-colonial India that is unabashedly capitalist with the politics that's nativist, insular, and increasingly ethno-nationalist. So talk us through that journey. How did you get here from your first book?
Okay, but thank you so much for asking this, because this is actually, in a way, goes to the heart of the project that I have been doing, that, this whole notion of new India, that when I was actually finalizing my partition book, And in fact, I was dealing with the whole question of New India at the time, and New India, which was inaugurated in 1947, namely the political independence of India. But when I was working in the first decade of the 21st century, and once again, we began hearing about New India. But it wasn't the New India that I was writing about. It was a different India which was unfolding, namely the economic independence of India. So the whole question of economic liberalization became a kind of built as the second liberation. And second liberation, which is finally going to bring about that sovereignty, which is very much attached not just to political, but also economic independence. And what you could see at the time is that a different kind of imagery began to be produced of what India is all about. And imagery is so central to this project, because as you know, the sensitivity of about how India is represented or how India is pictured within India and abroad has always been so central to this imagination of being Indian. And here you could see that India was producing its own, what I call the image catalog. It was almost like you're creating a picture album, you know, of the nation, taking your own selfies. And this is what I'm looking at, those, you know, those campaigns, which as you may have seen, like it was remarkable how many different image campaigns were launched at the turn of the century. And the last quarter century has simply been filled with that imagery of new India, a new India which is perceived or presented, pitched as, a more confident, a more worldly wise India. You know, the pictures of image, middle class prosperity, and also an India which can, crack jokes at itself. So I think this is those, in a way, my two works, look at two key moments in the life of what we call New India.
I think what's also equally important is the past and the fact that India was part of the Third World for the first few decades. And this moment in the 80s, when liberalization commenced, was also a period where India could be rediscovered or India could be renewed, right? And so that past also, in a way, contributed to how much we were willing to think about an India that's rising or that could rise, right?
So I think the whole question of rising is or emerging is very interesting, because like we begin asking, like, what precisely is emerging? What is rising? And basically, one set of answers would, of course, be the material transformation which is going on, namely the whole question of investments and the emergence of the middle class, prosperity, etc., which we talked about. But another thing which is tremendously important is that how the vision of the world began shifting, because it's the same India that we're talking about, but the ways in which the world began looking at India is different. And that is the story that I have been trying to connect, namely the processes which are inherently global, located elsewhere in the world, and the processes which are unfolding in India. And what I mean by that is that there is a longer history here where the Third World begins to be rediscovered, actually already in the mid 20th century, and which all deals with questions. Sometimes we speak in terms of development, sometimes we speak in terms of modernization. But at the same time, I think less attention has been paid to that how Third World countries were encouraged to take the path of economic liberalization and to be self-reliant in a way, right? But that did not take off until the last, the late 20th century, at the end of history, after Soviet Union, is in decline and Berlin Wall has fallen, and this whole idea that a new world is emerging, and that world is of liberal free markets, right? So emergence has to be located on the intersection of these global national processes, because there are so many economies across the world which, adopt that path. And here I would also be very cautious that the usual story of what we call globalization is presented as something where, outside forces come and, subjugate you and you, comply with it. But here, what I'm trying to show is that it is the national elite, which are, in dialogue with the global elite elsewhere. So this is the story of the elite and how an entire story of emergence, is created and perpetuated.
Do you think this is what's happening to Bangladesh right now? And especially over the last few years, we see a lot of attention, fanfare, and that Bangladesh is now an economic success story, and it's something that other countries should look at, especially in other parts of South and Southeast Asia. I kind of see a similar kind of trend here.
This is so important, again, what you're mentioning, because I think what the story that I'm telling is, of course, about India, but it's a bigger story than India, because India has been the prime example, which, you know, where the national elite adopt the free market formula and the ways in which it is welded into national politics in such a way that India story or growth story becomes central to our politics. But what you can see is that other countries, actually a vast number of countries, especially in the third world, have also adopted this formula. And the branding thing that I'm talking about, where you know, convert national identity into a brand identity, that is actually happening in Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, in Nepal, even Pakistan. I think a lot of people would not even think about Pakistan in such terms, because Pakistan has often been imagined in terms of, you know, the frontline state against, you know, terror, you know, war against terror, etc. But few would have noticed that there is also something called Startup Pakistan, a whole program, or Emerging Pakistan, which is, of course, it is quite aligned with the Chinese investment programs, you know, but what you can see is that the free market formula as a ticket to success on the world stage is something which has become far, like it has a wider resonance.
So this book is really, it asks a really ambitious question at the heart of it. It asks us to consider what is a nation state in the 21st century. And also that it's important to center questions around the nation state, around that economic logic, that globalizing economic logic, which you just laid out. Before we get into the weeds of the argument, can you lay out how capitalism and not globalization or free markets, and you make that distinction in the book, serves as a tool or focus through which the nation and the state, India in this case, acquires stature and power?
I think I have been very particular about making a distinction between globalization and capitalism, for the simple reason that globalization almost became, you know, an innocent kind of cover, like something which does not reveal too much, but actually it hides a number of processes. Basically, globalization, the standard textbook explanation is that this is about movement, this is about freedom, it's about coming across boundaries. And of course, who will be against that? Because we all, you know, this imagination of a cosmopolitan, multicultural world. So globalization, in a way, you know, married free market ideas together with the vision of a cosmopolitan world. And this is where I think we, like, lot of, you know, also scholarly works lost sight of, the fundamental transformation elsewhere, which is going on, namely, the free market model, which eventually leads us to this stage today, you know, where the counterintuitive or counterproductive, effects of this kind of, losing sight. What I mean to say is that when we speak about, you know, that nationalism is coming back, or nation first policies have come out, or the globalization pact has sort of broken down, then we have to ask, why did it happen? Well, it is happening because we lost sight of the fact that nationalism had never gone out. And this is what I'm talking about in terms of brand new nation, namely, that in this whole notion that we have free markets, the world is flat, right? There are no borders. You know, we are free human beings. What we witnessed was that national identity, in a very counterintuitive way, was actually being strengthened, because India, precisely in mid-1990s, began to be transformed into brand India. And I'm specifically mentioning, this governmental agency, which very few people have actually noticed, or few people even know about, the India Brand Equity Foundation, which was basically, work between the Confederation of Indian Industries and the Ministry of Commerce, and several what you call public-private partnerships. And what basically you're doing is that you're reviving India. It started with Made in India, like basically selling Indian products, which is something which has an old history altogether. Of course, every country wants to export products. But as you can see, eventually it leads us to Make in India, that India becomes the center of, primarily imagined as a space of production and exchange. Mm. So this transformation is, in a, again, I'm saying it's a counterintuitive thing, that just when we are told that national identities or nationalism, nation doesn't mean anything, what you see is that within the sphere of commerce, national identity is being reshaped. So this is what I'm proposing, that yes, nation first policies or nationalism, return of nationalism, it cannot be a complete surprise, because nationalism has been refashioned. We are not going back into an era of nationalism of 19th century, but rather the 21st century nationalism is something which is produced in the sphere of free markets.
What's really refreshing is your conceptualization of capital as not just something that's tangible or material, but there's a clear social and cultural aspect to it. And what's important here is hope and the production of hope that can rescue India and propel it on the path toward prosperity. So what role does hope play in India's development, in India's economic renewal?
I think this is so interesting because it's a sentiment, right? And it is not something which can be quantified. And much of how we think about economy or the economic questions as such is panned into graphs, charts, or quantified knowledge. But much of my work, of course, is qualitative. And what I could see is that when you speak to people, especially in the business policy circles, because I was working with the Indian elite or the global elite as such, that they would also speak about, these terms, like the business circuits, as you know, it's all about buzzing with hope, optimism. Like there is a whole, aesthetics of speaking about, world life, as such, which is like, there cannot be any failure. There cannot be, like, if you speak about, like, you have to be positive always. You must always see, there is light behind the cloud. So this is the culture, right? And what you could see is that first of all, this sentiment that there is, hope ahead. But here, hope, what I'm also suggesting is that it has a very material basis as well. And what I mean by that is that when you sell a country as an investment destination, what you're selling is a promise. What you're selling is a potential where you as an entrepreneur is invited to come and make it. In other words, it is not a product which is ready, but what you're selling is a potential promise. And the entire economy is literally run on, I think I would draw your attention to many of these projections which come out quarterly, annual, that India is all set to gain by 5% or something, or now Moody's has, scaled you up or scaled you down, the ratings, AAA, BBB, the whole, what you would notice is that very seldom in the Indian media, you would talk about what is the state of the economy, because that is not seen as a good thing because you're being negative. But what is played up are any projections. And projections are always, kind to drive up, because here the investment is as much, more you hype, more the possibility that you will get investments. I'm not saying that it always works out like that, but it is this economy of hope that how it plays in investment circles that I've been trying to pin.
I want to get to the individuals who are responsible for driving up this hope in a bit. But before that, I want to ask you about the images that you've used in the book. Since you do mention the book that it began as a, and I quote here, fascination with publicity images, particularly those like India Story, New India, and Incredible India. I think what's really striking is your analysis of these images, which, as you put it, amounts to a remixing of history, where the modern and thriving parts of India coalesce with the ancient and exotic. What was it like to use and analyze these images? And was the choice to fuse these two seemingly contradictory images of India strategic to fuel its brand, as you characterize it?
I think for most of us, who have grown up in India and, coming of age, so to say, in 1990s, because that was a moment of, shifting, because the sense that something is changing and then you're trying to, live through. So I'm a product of that era of transformation. So of course, I've been bewitched by these images altogether, like so many other people. So I think remixing is something, it's not me making this argument. Actually, I picked up this term remixing from the publicity material, where literally there is an ad which talks about that India is being remixed, like we are remixing history. And what it basically means is, well, it is the old India. It is that India, which is, here comes that idea that India is a civilizational nation, that India is not, it has an old history, etc. But that history is being made palatable or being readjusted to the current, within the global aesthetic frame. And this is something which was, repeated quite a lot. And the term that I came across was smart image. That India was not presented smartly enough. India did not appear as a smart nation. And now we are producing a smart, so of course, smart. And then I pushed, what does it mean to be smart as a nation? So again, the qualities which are associated are that, first of all, India, which is presentable, that you're not ashamed of it, embarrassed of it. India, which will be adored, when other people look at it. And an India, which is not just beautiful to look at, but also able to poke fun at itself, right? So that a sign of confidence is that you are not too sensitive, that you can take, that you can take humor in a good way, etc. Right? So, and this is important because, if I may align that with all another thing which started happening in 1990s, which was in Bollywood, in the film circuit, where you may have noticed that a very large number of films which began to be made, they had, that they were very, very global in nature. Mm-hmm. Like they would just go to Switzerland, New Zealand, wherever in the world. So it was this idea of an India, an Indianness, which was very much at home in the world, right? So I think remixing history is literally the production of, and what in the minds of the advertisers is, an old ancient civilizational country, but one which is also an investment worthy destination, but also, a place where, India is finally emerging on the global stage, completely at home as a world player. Now I'm using these terms because these are the terms which are consistently. So, you imagine constantly that there is something called the world stage, which is of course a metaphor. And it's about that India is finally able to recover its globality.
So like discussions at Davos, where you were a part of, and you spoke to a lot of individuals who were using these images and trying to create a new identity. And I want to get to that. And I want to get to the fundamental point which you make in the book is that nation building today is different from nation building of the past. That nation building is now nation branding. And what's absolutely crucial here are the efforts of those people beyond the state. So not just leaders and policymakers, but a wider community of citizens, business executives, policy experts, social media influencers that are now working to craft and uphold this image. And this is something that you start off the book with at Davos, at the India Adda, if I recall correctly, where these influencers and elites are reinvigorating and repackaging India's story in really interesting ways. And what's fascinating is that these figures are part of a larger anti-politics, as you identify, in that they are largely apolitical, technocratic actors that remain at a remove from politics, even though the work that they do is absolutely political. So how do these individuals acquire power and work with one another within this realm?
Of course, I mean, this set of elite that we are talking about, these are not political leaders as such. And many people that I interviewed, they would consistently talk about the work, their work, as something which was beyond politics, that they were doing a form of national service. And that India, and they would often talk about that, we don't get too much money out of it. We don't make too much money, but we do it because we feel this is so important. So it almost became a kind of, national service, which private, public, that this was not just a government. Actually, in fact, a lot of people would talk about that favorite line that India grows in the night. Or whatever happens in India, it happens despite the government, not because of the government. So in a way, it was very much like anti-governmental line. And please recall that this is also during those years when there is a very big anti-corruption movement where government is seen as the cesspit of all sorts of problems, right? So these individuals would set out to solve the problems which government had actually created. So this is the setup here. So but the thing is that all these shifts could not have come about, without the framework of, economic reforms, where, technocratic knowledge or expert knowledge is seen as far more important. So I think, you mentioned something about, could you repeat, one of your questions?
How do these actors acquire power and work with those within the political realm?
Yes, so I think it is basically, as I said, like it began as something where you are charged with creating campaign imagery, but it became something far bigger than, as I said, merely making campaigns, because this became almost like a kind of movement which included corporate CEOs, publicity designers, and bureaucrats who would, see themselves as CEOs, because often I was introduced to people who was like, no, he's not really like a bureaucrat type. He is, almost like a CEO. And then I realized that CEO was literally not a designation, it was an honorific, basically to see that he has the work ethic of a private company, basically, right? That more efficient, etc. And I think this is something which has percolated, almost as a national duty, as you have seen in the last few years, where the very notion of being a citizen of India, of brand India, literally means that you must speak up your nation, that you must always come up with the good news, you must spread the good word, you must only circulate positive images, because this is what enhances India's place in the world, its economic value, its stature as an investment destination, which outcompetes everyone, right? And you could see, and as you know, in the business management circles, to be positive is something which is required, because business runs literally on good news, right? If there is bad news, you hide it. And that kind of ethic has also percolated to how nations are run now. And which basically, and you may have seen that during the pandemic, this came out very clearly, where actually there was a hashtag positivity on social media, which was launched by the Indian government and supported by the Indian government in many different ways, where the citizens were asked to share their positive stories, right? So I think that was very interesting, that we are in the middle of the pandemic and there is a lot of bad news, but a brand nation requires that we must find good positive news, even in the dark depths.
I think it's important to realize here that Modi's brand and his rise was also on the back of such an anti-politics that exploited existing anxieties and extolled aspects like governance and strongman politics to protect capital. So Modi was ostensibly the answer or cure to the ills that were plaguing India and to unleash its potential. And as I read this, I wondered whether, obviously this discourse also mattered, but were there other conditions that also accelerated Modi's rise and this brand? Namely, which, as you pointed out, like the ineptitude of the opposition parties, especially the Congress, the role of technology and how good the BJP has become in using that to their advantage, especially social media. So how do did these other factors and conditions have an effect relative to the narrative and discourses that you argue?
Of course, this is a very complex field and also, you know, pretty uncertain. But I think one thing I would say specifically about the rise of Modi is that it is very much tied together with the economic liberalization policies. And this is so important because BJP or, you know, Hindu nationalism has been around. It has a very old history. But it never came to the center stage of Indian politics. It was always seen as somewhat marginal, right? And that their calling card or their rise in Indian politics was connected with, you know, the Babri Masjid, you know, demolition or, you know, the making of the temple, you know, the temple demand and Ram movement, etc. But still, it was always marginal. What made the difference was vibrant Gujarat, because that was the first time that there is a, and of course, this is, of course, we must remember, this is happening in the Vajpayee era, where policies which were set by the Congress Party in 1990s, they were actually adopted wholesale by the BJP and they were continued. So as you know, there is a big fight right now about the legacy, who did what in 1990s, right? But we know who did what in the sense that the policies, the fundamental shifts took place in early 1990s and they were carried on. And those factionalism within BJP that, as you know, there is Swadeshi Jagran Manch, which calls for Swadeshi, you know, economics as well, and which still exists, by the way. So the faction which was non-Swadeshi, which sided with capital, the mobility of capital, which is where Indian capital, you know, as you know, there is nothing called in that sense Indian capital. Capital is global, right? Yeah. So that puts a weight behind Modi. And that kind of partnership, the state capital partnership, eventually, you know, the you know political power and the economic power coming together, that is what underlies. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that Congress had a particular kind of political profile, namely where economic liberalization was their, you know, claim that we are doing for the good of India. This is what we are doing. But that was also captured, you know, by the BJP. And made, you know, brought alive by Modi. So I think this is where you can see that if Congress is not, or other political parties are not able to make a headway on the national stage, because regionally, a lot of other different things are taking place, but nationally it is like, so what is it which is your pitch? I think this is where economic and political, social, cultural, you know, BJP has, at the moment, captured. It may change because nothing is ever set in stone.
And that was going to be my next question. Is that brand which you write about unassailable? Whether it's brand India or Modi, and have you reached a point where no event or crisis, even an epochal one like COVID-19, can meaningfully dent or question this narrative? I know that you've been working and writing on the farmer protests in Punjab. Do you see that as a critical juncture that could affect what happens going ahead?
I think this has been the last year or so, or during the pandemic, has been extraordinary in many ways. And first of all, let's agree that the brand India or brand new nation that we are talking about is a particular kind of condition. And that sets the framework for politics, how politics is shaping up. Here, we must make a distinction between brand India and brand Modi, because they are not the same, because brand Modi exists because it promises to enhance brand India, right? But what we have seen is that that it is brand India which has become the, you know, the vehicle on which, you know, brand Modi has become so dominant within Indian politics. And that model is something that every wannabe politician wants to adopt. Now, the example that which is in front of you is UP, where UP, as you know, has launched massive publicity campaign where Adityanath, Yogi Adityanath is being pitched as the leader of the Hindutva movement, the inheritor, but also someone who is, for example, trying to make UP, you know, UP has a very big brand investment program right now, at least in terms of publicity, that it is going to be techno hub and et cetera, all the language that you would hear at World Economic Forum and whatnot, right? So this means some consultants are sitting there literally doing this. So what I'm saying is that there is this formula that a lot of people are adopting. But what is interesting is that already a shift has taken place even within this, framing of nation brand politics. Mm-hmm. How? Because here what has been strengthened altogether is, Hindu nationalist identity. Because you see, from Vajpayee to Modi, from Modi to Yogi, I mean, you can see how many steps have been taken here. But what is consistent in this, that how economic and the political, social, cultural, all these are trying, are attempted, to be put together, consolidated, right? So the question is, how will the capital vote? Who will the capital support? Because these are not small, like minor, trivial questions, right? In the sense like, take the case of Tatas. You recall in, was it 2008 or 9, when it happened in Bengal, when, there was a farmers like peasant movement and Tatas were, not given that land. And overnight, we are told that Modi offered Tatas and they shifted to Gujarat. Mm-hmm. And then that became the basis of that, look, Gujarat model, because this is where investments come, this is where prosperity happens. And that is something which we'll implement everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Likewise, if companies, big companies, foreign or Indian, they decide to, set up some factory or something in UP, that also becomes a kind of, blue stamping that companies want to be here. So what I'm trying to point is the coming together of economic and political power. But what we, as I said, last year has been extraordinary, and the farmers movement was completely unexpected. No one had counted upon that. And it wasn't just Punjab, as you know, it is Haryana, it is, it is Western Uttar Pradesh. And then, even the farmers organizations from Maharashtra, from South India, they're coming together. What it showed was that yes, there is a kind of political churning, but that churning is not mediated through political parties necessarily. It wasn't the Congress party or any other political party. And these were literally, the unions, which were, and strong unions, because a lot of people have said, but why haven't the labor unions done the same? Because they also, the labor code was also passed. But that is because labor unions are not that organized. And they're very, very, Indian labor market is primarily informal labor. Right. So I think in that sense, what we have to understand is that, all of seen through the prism. And by branding, I literally mean the coming together of the political and the economic. This is where we see that even opposition is taking a different kind of mode.
So you presented and talked about the book extensively over the past year. Have you reflected on the reception and feedback since then? There's a famous line that Foucault uses that once a book's out in the world, it takes life of its own. What life has this book taken, in your words?
Well, I think my biggest surprise has been that a lot of economists And, people in the financial world have shown quite a lot of interest. Now, someone like with my background, which is history anthropology, I think I had not even thought about that. So what surprised me was that it wasn't just my usual, academic, scholarly circle, but actually people outside that, a lot of investors, financial newspapers were very interested in that. So I think it was for somebody like me, like, what? Like, would you even be interested? And they were actually so interested in understanding, because I think this is where, because I, like, here, I'm an outsider to that world, right? And I was writing about it. And I think there are not many who have actually written about that elite world of, where financial, investment bankers meet bureaucrats, meet politicians, So I think this was my surprise, so to say, that this book has been received way beyond its usual expected and a very interesting feedback, and which only, as I said, made me realize that this is something which continues to be, needs to be, this is not done. This is not done. There are new chapters continuing, to be unfolded, and which is what I'm working on at the moment.
And what are you working on now?
I think two things. One, as I said, I'm writing, a new history of the third world, primarily, which, everything that we read about, the third world movement or the post-colonial world, is in a particular sense, which everybody is aware about. What I'm trying to do is to look at the ongoing transformations where we need to revise much of, this north-south dynamics or, like the ways in which we envision, the cartography of the 21st century world. And the second thing is about the nature of politics, as the last thing that I talked about. Is it really the political parties that we must focus on, or are we missing out on, what is the nature of politics at this moment where state capital relations are of a particular kind, right? So I think this is, in the next year or two, I hope I'll be able to publish some of it.
I want to end with a personal question. What was the hardest part of writing the book?
Well, the hardest part, of course, is always personal, in the sense that I had my daughter in between, and then I had to, travel quite a bit. And then I had to juggle between, having my little infant daughter, and I had to rely upon my family, my husband. It also therefore took me much longer than I would have, otherwise been able to accomplish. And in between, so I think I just think, okay, all right, I'm just grateful that, I was able to do it. And I think this is how it is for, parents, who have young kids. And the lesson I learned was that you need not beat yourself up. It took me longer, but then it's done at some point,
Rhonda, thank you so much.
Thank you too.
And that was Ravinder Kaur, the author of Brand New Nation, Capitalist Dreams and Nationalist Designs in 21st Century India, published by Stanford University Press. I'm Karthik Nachupan, and you've been listening to the Lake Podcast.